we move into net zero in the way that is currently planned, we will go backwards in terms of our gender parity in the UK, because all of the investment in jobs is in material science, construction, engineering, technology, where we're still struggling to get women into those roles and keep them in those sectors.
Welcome to Stand Tall with Rachel Bell, brought to you by Stride Treglown. Stand Tall is conversations with people blazing a trail across property, architecture, engineering and construction. Expect fast-flowing conversations about life, careers and defining moments. And stay tuned for the quickfire questions towards the end for pearls of wisdom, advice and humour. My guest today is Alice Williams, Vice President for Strategy at Schneider Electric, a global company leading the digital transformation of energy management and automation for greater sustainability. Alice has a fascinating background, initially training as an engineer. She worked her way up through the ranks of the British Army, specialising in intelligence and reconnaissance work. In 2019, she transitioned into the world of business and has since become a key voice for gender equality and female representation in traditionally male-dominated industries. Stay tuned today for discussions around squiggly career paths, model soldiers, STEM blinkers, and invisible women. Welcome, Alice, and thanks for joining us today. Could we just start with an overview of your current role at Schneider Electric, please?
Of course, Rachel, and thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited about our conversation. So I'm currently the Vice President of Strategy at Schneider Electric for the UK and Ireland. It's one of those brilliantly broad and slightly complicated role titles where I have classic strategy development and execution. I have mergers and acquisitions, strategic intelligence, but I also have parts of our software business and any new businesses as well. So for us at the moment, particularly around things like consultancy. So it's quite a moving, changing beast, but really great fun.
There is so much in that title. What would you kind of do on a typical day or typical week?
So I actually have a lot of my week already dedicated to time with my team. And that's something which always goes in the calendar first. So I sort of have leaders of each of those areas and we dedicate the check-in time. And so that takes up a good proportion of my week. And then the rest can be quite dynamic. So sometimes it might be external meetings around things like public policy. So I sit on a few boards for things like decarbonisation of the industrial sector. And we tend to spend time in working groups there. Sometimes it will be in workshops. So actually, I've got a workshop in a couple of weeks where we'll spend 2.5 days rewriting the 3-year strategy plan for one of our business units. Sometimes it will be actually, I have quite a lot of a sort of chief of staff role in there. So you know what it's like, coordinating and corralling the rest of the business and convening lots of meetings. And then also a lot of time with some of our strategic customers as well. So we've got some brilliant customers who are allowing us to pilot new concepts, new ideas. And so spending some really frank time with them, getting feedback and seeing where we've done well and where we haven't.
And I'm sure those that have tuned into other episodes might be thinking, well, how does this apply to sort of the construction sector? And Alice and I met at a recent CBI event, and I was truly inspired really by your journey, but also the approach to diversity, leadership, sustainability, and certainly many of the other topics that hopefully we will cover today. But I thought it would be fantastic for people to hear. I wonder if we step back into your early career and sort of your engineering background, which I think, again, will be very relevant for a number of our listeners. Where did it all start?
So for me, at a really young age, actually, I knew what I wanted to do and be from the age of about 15, and that was to be a pilot. And I applied to the military to be a pilot. At that age, they have scholarship programs and things. And I was told at a very young age, and why I love the name of your podcast, Rachel, that actually I was too small to be a pilot. I'm too short. My arms are too short. And so it was a straight no, but I was offered an engineering scholarship. So I was sponsored to do my A-levels and then my degree by the Ministry of Defence. And then I subsequently served for 9 years in the army, starting as an engineer and then moving into different roles. And I think actually engineering felt exciting, if you like, a new option post thinking that I was going to be a fast jet pilot, because it was really about how stuff works, how and why stuff works. And I found that really exciting, and I found I could apply it to lots of different things as well. So it all began there. And to be honest, I've made quite a lot of different moves. And I had someone in the military use a wonderful phrase that has stuck with me, where she said, there is no longer a kind of career ladder. It's the Harry Potter staircase. And so I feel like, you know, my career has taken those various turns, different directions, and all of it has felt like a build and really exciting.
Well, even in those first few bits, there is so much that we can pick up on. Certainly, as you say, I think we struck a chord when, both around 5 foot tall, we were discussing about the challenges of being small. And it would be really useful to talk about your impression on what a leader looks like. We'll come on to that in a bit, I think. But let's drop back to your career in the army. I'm really interested to hear about sort of how that evolved, the challenges that you faced, certainly being a female in something which I see is still very male, and sort of the challenges and just obviously in an officer's role, how that came about and type of things that you were involved with.
Absolutely. I think when I joined the army, so when I started at the Royal Military Academy Sandhurst, it was around 10% of the force were female. And it really depends on where you are in the army as to whether that's a lot lower. And I had significant periods in my career where I was the only, and there were lots of types of the only, you know, those that have been there know how lonely that can be, or actually where you've got a higher proportion of women as well. I guess I'd had a bit of a warm up to it in that I studied aeronautical engineering at Loughborough University, which, because of sports and engineering, is a very male dominated environment. But I think the real difference is that need to feel like you are professionally credible in an environment where you do seem like someone who's slightly out of place. And that is not only gender-based, but can be in terms of your physical stature as well. The army is an incredibly physical career. I was a gymnast as a kid, so I was always very fit. But actually, you know, your size, and when you put a kind of 40 kilogram bag on your back, or you're asked to get over a 12 foot wall and things like that, you've got this both professionally competent, but also, am I physically capable? And that need that we can have to overperform and overcompensate from things, I think, came out quite early in my career. So I always did extra fitness in the morning, as well as the fitness you do with the army. But I think I also adopted quite a seriousness in my early career, because I desperately didn't want anything to detract from the investment I was making in trying to become a good leader, trying to be a good officer. I think the good thing for me is I have an interest and probably a flair for organization and planning. And if you ask any of my friends and family, I love it. I'm a real planner. And that is very, very valuable in most military contexts, particularly in an engineering context. So traditionally, those early engineering roles that I was doing, I was working on the vehicle fleet. So you're thinking about, how do I keep as many vehicles fit for operations or in the battle for as long as possible? How are we going to service them in the middle of an operation? How are we looking after all of the ancillary things like the weapon systems, the sighting systems? And so actually being someone who loves a spreadsheet, loves a Gantt chart, you know, loves that, is quite useful. And I think what I also did dual track through my career, I sort of started off with this being quite serious, maybe overcompensating, but then also having the more healthy side of, what are my unique skills and what can I lean on to then actually start to say, this is what I bring to the group. And that was something which, probably 2 years in, I started to really rest on more and say, if I can't necessarily be the expected model version of a soldier, what am I bringing? What's my unique value proposition? And that is exciting both individually, but also when you start to lead teams, because you can enable people who, turns out, actually, my experience in the army shows no one is a model soldier, and we've all got these fears and these areas where we feel we're lacking. And so much of it is getting to the core of what you love and what you're great at, and then really offering that up to the service.
I absolutely love that. And there's so many other discussions that I'm sure we could take through just the lessons that you've learned. And so you were at the army for 9 years.
Yeah, I served 9 years. It's quite interesting. And I think it set me up well for leaving, in that you move roles really, really often. So every kind of 18 months or so, you're moving into a new role, a new team, a new location. So again, you're doing all this. What's my role in the team? What's the mission? Who are the people? Who are the stakeholders? Different locations. I had the privilege to serve all over the world, both in operational theatres like Afghanistan, but also in places like NATO headquarters in Brussels, or sort of additional missions to places like Ghana, Malaysia, etc. So really varied, really, really interesting. And I actually changed roles through that time as well. So I'd started as an engineer, but I actually ended up being both drawn towards and selected for intelligence roles. And people often ask me about how you make the link from one to the two. And a lot of engineering for me is taking disparate component parts and synthesizing them into something that works. And actually, intelligence is the same. You're taking disparate parts of information and synthesizing it into something which is actionable. And I really enjoyed that because it was about people and it was about behaviors. And it felt really exciting and really real to me.
Just the fact that you've experienced that, would you recommend other people to look at that as a career?
Yeah, absolutely. I didn't serve as long as, you know, lots of people will stay a full career and they'll retire from the military. You can leave after 3 years, so I'm sort of somewhere in the middle. But I think it's extremely formative and it makes you who you are, which is both opportunity and a threat, I guess.
And I think, as you pointed out, I love the term, the sort of Harry Potter staircase. I listened to another podcast called Squiggly Careers, and that is as much about the scramble net, talking about fitness, of actually not this whole linear path of a career, but you might sort of dot from side to side and up a bit and back a bit. So how did you then transition into sort of the corporate world? And when we spoke before, there was that sort of transition and finding that purpose and understanding where you can take all of those skills into a totally different situation. Mm. How did you find kind of moving away from what I'm sure is quite a structure and teamwork, etc.? How did you then move into that next stage?
So I invested a lot of time and really getting to know myself during my transition period. So you give sort of 12 months notice to leave the military. And one of the things I observed about a lot of my friends who left is it all gone towards certain job roles. So people go into project management from the part of the army I'm from, or lots of people go into finance. And you see them struggling and you hear about veterans struggling quite a lot. And a big part of it felt like this need to be really clear about your own identity outside of the uniform. So when you wear a uniform, it tells everybody who you are, how important you are, where you've been, what you do. And that, as I say, it sort of makes you who you are. But I saw it as an opportunity to redefine who I was and what I wanted to work on. So I did a lot of, again, going back to what are my key skills and value drivers? What can I offer? But also, what do I really care about? What do I want to work on? And I sort of call it big hand, small map. And I figured if I could boil it down to a couple of things that really mattered to me, actually, I wasn't starting to look for really niche opportunities and putting myself down a rabbit hole. All of a sudden, there were lots of things I could both be great at and also I could be really excited at, which I think is so important for us in our careers. And I got really clear that the things I was passionate about were sustainability and countering climate change and gender equality and opportunities for women and girls. Super simple. If I could work on either of those two missions, I knew that I'd be excited and I'd be passionate and I'd throw my whole weight behind things. I'm an all or nothing person. So whatever I'm doing, I'm throwing my weight behind things. That felt really exciting because it didn't pigeonhole me into going into, say, an engineering role because I have the qualification, or project management role because I've got experience doing that, or even an operational kind of maintenance role, if you like. So I have a history in that. It meant I could look for something where the vision and mission felt exciting, and then had really dynamic conversation with Schneider around what my skills were. I mean, if I reflect back on the early conversation, it was really hard to describe it. We all have our own language and lingo, and bridging it is quite challenging. But I think what came across is I knew what my key skills were and I could articulate it simply in a compelling way. I knew what I was excited to work on and what I'd say no to. And so actually I could go confidently into a new career, knowing that I'd be excited, I would learn some new things, and also I'd have something to offer. And I think that's applicable to people at any point in their career. There's a wonderful book I love called The 100-Year Life, and it talks about these chapters of our careers and how actually I love the squiggly career analogy. You know, all of us at some point are going to have to make a change. And so this idea that you drive it, and it's really centered on what you feel confident you're good at and what you love and care about, felt like good practice for me. I haven't nailed it, but it felt like a really good practice to try that on and see how it felt and find an organization that reflected what I wanted to do.
Yeah, it's really fascinating. And certainly two of those elements, and one that I would love to pick up on, is around the gender equality. But I think first, you've been quoted about saying sustainability is and will continue to be at the core of everything we do. And also around, you mentioned net zero targets. I remember sitting and listening to you talk about the ways that different materials and different sectors can learn from one another. And I remember the analogy or the example that you gave around this orchid and the materials that from the orchid could be used and being used in a very different way. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about then, and certainly in the current climate of energy and costs and all of those other things, which I'm sure we could spend hours talking about, but to draw that back in terms of you and sustainability, how are you driving that forward at the moment? What's the kind of key drivers, and how are you learning from other examples or other industries?
What a wonderful question. And it probably starts to bring in our gender equality piece as well. So there's a great study by PwC about gender equality. And one of the things they caution on is that if we move into net zero in the way that is currently planned, we will go backwards in terms of our gender parity in the UK by 1.5 percentage points. Because all of the investment in jobs is in material science, construction, engineering, technology, where we're still struggling to get women into those roles and keep them in those sectors. And so we've got to be really, really mindful about how we do that. And this then brings in this new piece around what has got us here will not get us there. And the discussion we were having about actually thinking differently and cross-pollinating, I think is the phrase I'm still trying on. And no one's had an awful reaction to it yet, so I'm going to keep using it. But cross-pollinating between sectors, you know, so we often, particularly with things like construction or engineering, get very STEM about it, is probably the phrase I'm going to use. And we sort of like to put our STEM blinkers on and say, the STEM mindset knows how to do this because it is STEM. And we've got the opportunity to really look across different sectors and probably bring in more women because they're represented more strongly in different sectors and get different thinking and use creativity that exists in, say, the fashion sector, which is what you're referring to. I met this wonderful entrepreneur who has been effectively installing orchid farms in underprivileged parts of the world, which she's now incorporated into a new material. And the material science was what got her. And so we've got the opportunity to bring in people from different sectors, understand their thinking, and maybe bring new ways and new methods of, particularly into construction, because that's one of the biggest challenges, both new build and retrofit, in terms of net zero in particular. Part of that also is then how we bring in the thinking early on in terms of projects we're designing. So you also have a very high percentage of women represented in the social sector and social care. And there's a lot of kind of evidence around where you've brought in the social care sector early on in planning phases for major infrastructure projects. You've actually both got something which serves a community better, is potentially more thoughtfully laid out, and wastes less money and is delivered on time because it's right first time. And so this idea of true ecosystems is what we're quite excited about at Schneider. And we're trying to work more and more in where we say it's going to take all of us, right? So we're an energy management and sustainability organization. We make electrical components. We make software that controls your electrical components. So we're a part of the puzzle, but it's going to take all of us. And so this idea of ecosystems that actually then are proving concept, piloting, trying new things and being willing to kind of put that on the line a little bit and open up our technology. You know, we've sat with competitors in Parliament on decarbonisation of heat meetings alongside competitors and talked about things because it's in our mutual interest. And ultimately, the market is also big enough for all of us in this sector. So I think that's one of the ways we're trying to approach it. And, you know, I'm finding true about Schneider 3.5 years in is really walking the talk. Is, for example, all of our software is open architecture by design, so that actually you can plug and play. So we'd love it, right, if it's a full Schneider fit out, but we also think it's important that it's in there and therefore it's compatible with any of the other options that you might look at in the market, or future-proofing as you need to modularize and add things. So I think that's the way we're really looking at it, is ecosystems, partnership, co-innovation, co-development, and ultimately at this point, we've got to break ground on pilots and try some of these things that we've all been talking about in working groups.
I think that's really interesting. And you talk about partnerships. We've talked about this actually for those that have listened to previous podcasts about my title and my role in terms of my partnerships and linking between companies, but that's certainly specific to the construction industry, but also the role that I've had through Women in Property and trying to support and encourage people to get into the industry, but also retain females, especially in the construction industry. And you mentioned about the PwC report, and I know that you're hugely involved in supporting women in Schneider and beyond. I just wonder what you see in terms of those networks. And I loved the point when we were talking before about bringing employees on board, but also finding that guiding star, or I think you use the reference North Star. Just talk us a little bit about the things that have been set up in Schneider, how that's helping the gender equality and supporting employees.
I guess around 18 months ago or so, we established our first ever women's network for the employee community for the UK and Ireland. So we've kept it regional, and there's US one and a French one that we're sort of linking up with as well. But we've got about 1,100 women in Schneider working within the UK and Ireland.
What percentage is that then across the business compared to the overall employment?
28%. Across the business. And so we feel we're behind. We're ahead of some sectors, but, you know, we really want to make moves on that. And different tiers, we're taking different approaches. But really, it was about how do we maximize the potential of all women? So we have bespoke programs for senior women in leadership positions. We're starting some bespoke programs around frontline managers as well. But a lot of it had been around if you wanted to be the next CEO, if you like. And actually, we wanted to create something which spoke to all women and recognized that all of them have different aspirations and different things that they want to unlock. And so we've called it the Potential of Women, PAL, which I definitely forced on the team. I got really overexcited that we can have a cartoon character as the kind of logo, but it sort of met what we were trying to achieve. And actually, there's a couple of things that have been powerful about it. So first off, we got to redefine why we were doing this and this idea of bringing the organization along. So you can never lead change by saying, because we have to report on it, or because there's a quota, or because there's an ambition. And actually, you've got to be really clear about the benefits it's bringing for the organization. So particularly in terms of bringing different thinking, bringing different skills, unlocking more of the workforce. I mean, we all complain that we can't find insert X skills when we're going out and recruiting. And women represent a high proportion of the workforce and are underrepresented, particularly when we're looking at things like returning to work, etc. So we did a lot around why that was important and finding great talent and also being able to retain it as well, partly through this Potential of Women vehicle. We also got to hold ourselves accountable to what women actually needed and wanted. Because you can run the risk of saying, we know what women, particularly as a woman, I know what women need, but I only know what I need because I've come through my specific journey. And so we tend to project what we think women need in terms of support based off our own experiences. And so it was really important to actually just listen to those 1,000 women and say, what blockers do you have? What do you actually want to do? What's important to you? What's interesting? And so we've created these sort of sub-circles, if you like. So we've got the overall network, which has a virtual monthly meeting. And then we call them listening circles, which are things like early careers or women in engineering or women in sales or women's health. And we've got 9 of those sub-circles, which have completely organically grown. So these are where employees have turned around and said, there is an issue that we need to take action on, and we're going to convene the right people to get clear on the detail and then propose an action plan. And then actually they come back to the steering committee if they need resources or support or a project team, and we're sort of managing it that way. It's been pretty organic. So it started literally as a post-it note on the table. It would have been December 2020. And this point, we just had our first in-person event. It was on a rail strike day in Manchester. We still got sort of 310 women turning up in Manchester. Incredible, electric atmosphere. I can't even describe it. It was absolutely amazing. And we have just shy of 300 turning up every month for the virtual calls where we cover different topics and then engaging with the assets kind of offline as well. We have quite a big population who are non-connected, so our factory workers, for example. That's a piece we haven't cracked yet in terms of how we get the information out, how we make them feel really included, how we, again, also listen to their needs. We've done a few physical road shows, but it's a bit of work in progress. And I think the things which feel really exciting about it is we're getting people trusted enough to give us real and genuine feedback. So we're getting really clear feedback on what we need to work on it. And I see that as a symbol of trust that they believe we will then act on it. We've had a couple of really interesting and quite exciting wins. So huge one on the menopause, a lot of time and focus spent on the menopause. And we now have a third party partner to help and support us with the menopause program, training for managers, support for employees, and an accreditation, which is really exciting. But also simple things like one of our project managers come forward and say, the PPE doesn't work for me. I can't get PPE for, you know, someone my size and my build. And so a complete review of the PPE that's available to women, including what could have been a disaster. So one of our men actually, who works in health and safety, was super pleased. He was the only person that thought that we might need an arc flash bra. So arc flash protective equipment, those that don't know, is there effectively when you're working with high voltage to help effectively stop you getting electrocuted if you manage to short yourself out. And so you can't wear any metal, you have to take all your jewelry off, etc. It's all PPE, but no one had thought to check whether women were wearing underwire bras or not. And so all of these little things have come out of this, some of them super small and tactical, some of them really, really meaningful. And it's a space where we can say all of it matters. And actually, we can get the right people behind all of it and move things forward.
As you say, it's fascinating just looking at the detail and what some things just fly by. No one thinks about it. It sort of rings true in terms of a number of books that I've been reading through lockdown around that gender disparity, certainly in places and designing and elements like Make Space for Girls, who have been looking at play spaces, which primarily are designed for boys, and trying to highlight that in the public sector support and finance to those places. So I was inspired by a book during lockdown called Invisible Women. It's by Caroline Criado Perez, and it pulls out lots of examples which expose the data bias in a world which has essentially been designed for the male form. She's also gone on to launch a podcast called Visible Women, and I'd highly recommend checking that out. I also wonder, through your career and life so far, has there been any particular role models that you've looked up to or certainly have influenced in any decisions that you've made?
There are a number, but I think the one that I should absolutely mention, particularly given our last conversation, is my mother. So I'm one of three girls. She also grew up in a time where women's careers taking the lead was even less common than it is now. And she was the first of her family to go to university and ended up as a dame at the end of her career in the civil service. And I think one of the things which I observed, and again, on this sort of how you forge your own path through leadership is, you know, again, she's very diminutive. She's tiny. She's also sparrow-like. I don't fit in her clothes. She's that kind of 60s twiggy type build, you know, absolutely tiny. And she took on huge, huge roles at points where things were going wrong. So she historically took on roles where something had already gone bang, and she really got put through the mill in terms of things like select committees and really looking at what certain departments had done. And she put herself in these positions, partly, I think, because, again, she knew it was her skill and her trait to do turnarounds, partly because I think she believed she had the strength to weather some of those storms. And it was just incredibly powerful to watch, particularly as I became, you know, a teenager and a young woman, to see her really holding that space in what would have been incredibly challenging circumstances and quite visible as well. And so I always use her as a role model of, you know, someone, again, both against odds, but also very clear, always very clear, very dogged, very determined through what would have been incredibly challenging successive roles effectively. And when I think about that in terms of leadership and the size of the organization she led, actually her being able to hold that presence of confidence, of clarity, of surety would have been incredibly important. So she's a sort of huge role model for me. I've also had a number of incredibly inspiring mentors and leaders, but also colleagues as well. And often we talk about sort of our leaders and our bosses when we think of role models, but I've had some exceptional people who've technically worked for me, but really have taught me everything I know. You know, one of my big beliefs is that it's always about people. Whatever you think you do, it's always about people. And so I've always been drawn to those and inspired by people who can really bring it back to that, who are focusing on things because of how it would make others feel, are thinking about people in terms of everything they do, and are actually creating a space for people to thrive and love things. So as I say, I've had people who've worked for me who have actually built my confidence, who supported me in terms of actually calling me out sometimes, pulling me aside and saying, you know, you need to focus on this. You need to do better here. I believe in you and I think you can, but you've got to focus on it. Always with that kind of grace and really offering me something to make myself better.
I think that's a really valid point as well from a leader, ensuring that people can actually approach you to be able to say that. So you're enabling them to feel trusted, comforted, and also that you are an approachable person to be able to challenge and challenge both you, challenge themselves. So that's really good. For someone who is extremely busy doing an exceptional role, what would keep you lying awake at night?
The fear of dropping a ball. Most certainly. I've always loved fast pace. I've always, you know, really enjoyed where there are lots of things going on. I drive, and it's something I'm conscious of with my own team. I drive quite a fast cadence. And one of the things I've been working on is then the perfectionism, because you can't do both fast pace and perfectionism. And that's the thing which, you know, I'm still working on it and certainly would keep me awake at night. It's less from, you know, something going catastrophically wrong, because actually I think, you know, I'm pretty good at prioritizing and managing and risk management. That obviously comes from my background. But it's more because I believe really strongly in everything we've started. And the idea, not necessarily of something failing and just having to iterate, but the idea of, you know, something not getting off the ground or the change that's needed, not being able to happen, creates some kind of stress. So often, you know, we'll get excited, we'll start a number of things, particularly because of the nature of my team and my role, all of those additional, you know, the and you've probably got this as well. Everything that's an and in an organization seems to come to us. And because, you know, we believe in it and we spend a lot of time creating that narrative and why it's important, I do have those moments where I'm like, well, we've got a lot of balls in the air. You know, the whole juggling analogy, I sometimes think we're not even juggling. We've just thrown them all up in the air. We're going to wait to see what happens when they land. And I think the other thing for me is a mantra above the door of the Royal Military Academy Sandhurst is serve to lead. And so this is an ethos that's really instilled in me, I think is very powerful. It's very, very important. And so in my head, I have always worked for my team. And if I work for my team and if I enable them and I create them the time and space and I make sure they have the tools, they will deliver the objective, whatever that is. And that's also something which I'm trying to learn as a leader, how far you get emotionally pulled into that. So there are points where, you know, I will worry a lot about, you know, maybe the pressure a team member is under or a decision they have to make, or if they're going through a phase where they're stepping up into a new role. And it's getting really clear on how much of that is justified and therefore maybe I need to create a bit more support, and how much of it is actually me and not letting go enough and enabling. But I think, you know, that idea of I actually work for my team. I don't work for my boss. I don't work for Schneider. I work for my team and they will deliver the results. It feels exciting. It feels powerful, but it comes with that challenge of how emotionally invested you get in those individuals.
And I think you pick up on a mantra there. That is one of our final parts of the podcast, is to pick up on things like that. So we will get back to that in a bit. We're running out of time, really, but just one other point is, how do you switch off? I know we had some really good conversations whilst you were in France a few weeks ago. And I just wonder, yeah, to give a little bit of insight into you as an individual and how you kind of switch off from all of the other amazing things that you're doing.
Yeah, so a lot of my work is very mental or communication based. Am I creative? I enjoy creative pursuits, I think is probably the best way to put it. I'm not good at any of them, but I enjoy, well, we do a lot of DIY. So we have a project ongoing, but I enjoy, for example, painting. I enjoy sewing. I enjoy creating things with my hands. And I say I'm not a creative probably because they're all rubbish, but I'm okay with that. It's more quite meditative effect, I think it has. I mean, my husband will tell you that sewing is the only thing where I do it absolutely single focused. Everything else, I can kind of be multitasking if I'm not managing myself well. He says he knows when I'm deeply into a project because I start the Darth Vader breathing. So I'm just so focused that I'm doing that kind of rattly breathing. I love that physically creating something and it being sort of very manual. I find it a real switch off. It's different. And I think it is important to have those things which are separate from work where, you know, it actually doesn't matter how good you are at them. It's more about the process and what you're investing in them.
Absolutely. And for those that haven't checked out, listen to the Ben Channon podcast, which is about mindfulness and exactly those types of things that do enable you to get away from the everyday brain activity and does enable you to just sort of switch off. So we talk about meditation, but also sort of yoga. And for me, sewing is one of my interests as well. I have a current project that's probably been on the go for the last 3 months, if not longer, I expect my husband would say. Mm-hmm. I tend to start things. I love the idea of fabric. Start things, but don't necessarily finish them.
We're such kindred spirits. There's nothing better than the fabric shop, honestly. And then you got all these wild ideas about what you're going to make out of it. And as you say, it never quite materializes. But that's not the point.
Excellent. I'm afraid we've run out of time. So as everyone knows, just before we finish, there is my quick fire round of questions for my guests. So the first one is about my mantra, and that is stand tall. And you've obviously mentioned the mantra that you have, which is serve to lead. I wonder, is that your mantra or do you have any other mantras that you stick to?
Certainly for my leadership style, a more general one and one I love is there is no hurry. Feels very important that rather than rushing from thing to thing or thinking that over there will be better than here, actually recognizing it's all a journey. So there is no hurry for everything in life is my real mantra.
That's a really good one. I started this year with one word instead of New Year's resolution, and that word was joy, to try and find the joy in everything that we do. I wonder if you could choose a guiding word for the remainder of this year, what would it be?
Again, we're kindred souls because I do the one word. So mine this year is connected. And I wanted that to be both to myself and what I needed, but also to others. So again, not multitasking, really connecting with people at a deep level.
Absolutely. I think the description that you say about the ecosystems and people and everything that we've talked about this morning has really rung true with a lot of the things that I stand by. And then finally, if there was one thing that you could change, and I think I'll change this slightly, about sort of society, the world, what would that be?
I think I'll link it back to my mantra, the incessant need for hyperspeed. And I think it creates all of those challenging things around over distraction, overwhelm, high pressure, overconsumption. I think it links back to that. And it's why it's my mantra is actually to stop myself being pulled into that vortex.
That's a really good one. And just the pace, and totally get that. Thank you, Alice. It's been amazing speaking to you today. Really glad that we connected. And do you have any points that people can reach out to you on, any social media platforms that particularly check you out on?
So LinkedIn is probably the best one for me. So Alice Williams at Schneider Electric and LinkedIn. I don't really do a lot of social media other than that. So that's probably the best place.
Brilliant. Thank you, Alice. Have a great day.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for tuning in today. I love talking to Alice and hope you enjoyed the listen too. It was her passion for partnerships and cross-pollination between sectors that really rang true for me. As always, links and resources from today's episode are in the show notes. Thanks to Stride Clown for sponsoring this podcast. If you want any further information on this podcast or Stride Clown, please visit stridetoclown.com and at Stride Clown on social media. You can follow me and let me know what you think of the show at Rachel_J_Bell across Twitter and Instagram. Stand tall and talk soon.